Well, hello everyone. My name is Paul Weber, and on behalf of my colleague, Dr. Syed Sattar, I'd like to welcome you to the teleclass, Strategies for Cleaning and Disinfection of Environmental Surfaces in Healthcare Facilities. Our faculty today is the very eminent Dr. John Boyce. I've had the privilege of introducing Dr. Boyce twice before, and it's in fact I've never really been satisfied with how I've been able to introduce him. There's so much more to say about this man. He is the Section Chief of Infectious Diseases at St. Raphael's Hospital. He is a Clinical Professor of Medicine at Yale University. He is the Chair of the CDC Hand Hygiene Task Force. He co-authored the CDC Guidelines on Hand Hygiene. He is a former president of SHEA. He has authored a great wealth of really top quality scientific articles. However, I think that Loretta Litz Fauerbach said it best last week at the end of her teleclass lecture. She said, "I heartily recommend John Boyce. I've worked with him on several initiatives, and he is stellar. He's a researcher, but he's also at the bedside, and he understands the complexities of healthcare." And to that, I think I have nothing more to add, except, of course, that this teleclass series is made possible in part by the very generous support of companies like Virox Technologies, who provide unrestricted grants and sponsorship funding. And to all of the folk at Virox, I thank you very much for your unwavering support of infection control research and education. To present the strategies for improving cleaning and disinfection of environmental surfaces in healthcare facilities, from beautiful New Haven, Connecticut, I give you Dr. John Boyce. Dr. Boyce.
Thanks very much, Paul, for that nice introduction. My mother would have loved it. I'm happy to join you today to talk about improving cleaning and disinfection in the hospital setting. If we can move on to the second slide, I wanted to make the point that patients with pathogens such as MRSA, VRE, C. difficile, and Acinetobacter frequently contaminate environmental surfaces in their immediate vicinity. And these organisms can remain viable on even dry surfaces for weeks or even months. The next slide points out that daily cleaning of surfaces near patients is often performed poorly. This upper picture you see on your right shows colonies growing on a blood agar plates. We cultured an overbed table before daily cleaning, and then when the housekeeper left the room, we cultured the overbed table again. And as you can see, there's virtually no decrease in the colony count, meaning that, in fact, the housekeeper probably barely touched the overbed table. Terminal cleaning of rooms after patient discharge is also often inadequate. Phil Carling and colleagues found that only 47% of surfaces that should have been cleaned during a terminal cleaning of a hospital room had actually been cleaned. And although I'm not sure it projects very well, the lower picture on your right shows a bunch of small gray colonies of VRE that were recovered from a call button after cleaning had been done. So there's plenty of evidence that in many hospital facilities, daily and terminal cleaning are not done very well. Now, on the next slide, it points out that contaminated environmental surfaces can actually contribute to transmission of pathogens, often by serving as a source from which healthcare workers contaminate their hands or their gloves. Contaminated medical equipment that comes into direct contact with a patient can also serve as a source of transmission. Next slide. Now, there's been at least three very nice studies that have shown that patients admitted to a room that was formerly occupied by a patient with VRE or MRSA are at increased risk of acquiring one of these organisms, suggesting that either the terminal cleaning of the rooms was inadequate and that patients acquired the organism either by coming into direct contact with contaminated surfaces or from healthcare workers who contaminate their hands in the room. Next slide. So I think if we now kind of agree that environmental contamination is common and that cleaning is often not done very well, the next question that we probably should be asking ourselves is, well, if you clean the environment better, is there actually any evidence that it reduces transmission of healthcare-associated pathogens? Well, Mary Hayden and colleagues in Chicago did a prospective 9-month study in an MICU that included admission and daily screening of patients for VRE, and they did environmental and healthcare worker hand cultures twice a week. Their study involved 4 phases. The first was a baseline period, and then phase 2 involved education of housekeepers. They started monitoring their performance and giving them feedback about how they were doing. Then phase 3 was kind of a washout period with no specific intervention. And then phase 4 involved a multimodal hand hygiene intervention. Next slide. Now, there are a couple important findings from this study. First of all, as shown in the green bars, the environmental cleaning rate increased significantly from period 1 to period 2 and then remained high throughout the rest of the study period. Secondly, VRE environmental contamination was shown to be decreased significantly as cleaning improved. And then, perhaps most importantly, as shown in the red line, VRE acquisitions by patients decreased significantly. And when the investigators looked at other potential factors such as hand hygiene compliance or colonization pressure, they really couldn't explain the decrease in VRE acquisitions by anything other than improved cleaning and reduced environmental contamination. So, in my opinion, this study probably presents the most compelling evidence that we have so far that improved cleaning of the environment can reduce infections. Next slide. Now, Mayfield and colleagues looked at Clostridium difficile transmission and found that it decreased significantly on a high-incidence ward after they changed from using a quaternary ammonium disinfectant to using a 1-to-10 solution of sodium hypochlorite, or bleach. And of interest, the incidence of C. diff rose back to the initial level after they switched back to a quaternary ammonium disinfectant. So this was pretty suggestive that cleaning the environment with dilute bleach, which is effective against C. diff, actually had an impact on C. diff transmission rates. The authors did point out that the 1-to-10 hypochlorite solution did not really reduce C. diff disease incidence much on low incidence wards, suggesting that maybe there wasn't nearly as much environmental contamination on those wards. Next slide. More recently, McCullen and colleagues used hypochlorite disinfection in 2 ICUs that had increased incidence of Clostridium difficile-associated disease. The hypochlorite was used in all the patient rooms in one ICU, and then the hypochlorite was used only in rooms that had C. diff disease in the other ICU. And what they found was that the incidence of C. difficile-associated disease decreased in both ICUs and remained low for 1.5 years, again suggesting that appropriate and effective disinfection of environmental surfaces can reduce C. diff transmission. Next slide. Well, based on some of the evidence I've already shown you today and on other papers that are published, CDC's Healthcare Infection Control Practices Advisory Committee, or HICPAC, and a recent SHEA-IDSA Healthcare Associated Infections Task Force have both recommended that healthcare facilities really ought to pay greater attention to cleaning and disinfection of equipment and the environment. Next slide. Now, some of the things that we can do to improve cleaning is to develop written protocols for both daily and terminal cleaning and disinfection of patient rooms. Also, if you're not doing this already, you should think about routinely assessing the adherence of your housekeepers to the protocols and looking at the adequacy of cleaning. We should be paying close attention to cleaning and disinfection of high-touch surfaces in patient care areas that are often touched by both patients and healthcare workers. And then we need to make sure that we provide appropriate training for housekeeping personnel. Next slide. Some of the factors that have been shown to contribute to suboptimal cleaning and disinfection practices include the fact that in a lot of hospitals, housekeepers and nursing staff don't agree on who is supposed to clean what. I know in our hospital this has been a problem for years. Housekeepers also don't always understand which detergent or disinfectant they're supposed to use, which concentration should be used, and how often they're supposed to change their cleaning cloths or their mop heads. Some other factors that contribute to suboptimal cleaning include the fact that there are increasing demands on housekeepers for fast room turnaround times, so they're often only given like maybe 25 minutes to do cleaning. Staff shortages and frequent turnover of housekeeping personnel also make it difficult to maintain high levels of cleaning proficiency. Next slide. This complicated slide shows part of a template that a multidisciplinary committee at Hospital of St. Raphael developed to try to spell out exactly what items should be cleaned and by whom. And on this slide, you see that it says that for routine daily cleaning of patient rooms, that environmental services is supposed to clean the items listed there. And I don't want to go into all the detail here, but I think it's important for hospitals to try to develop clear written policies for who is supposed to clean what. Next slide. Now, if we're going to monitor housekeeping practices, there's a couple of questions that we need to be asking. One is, were important surfaces wiped with an appropriate disinfectant or detergent? One strategy is to give a checklist to the housekeeper and have him or her check off items that they have cleaned either by daily cleaning or terminal cleaning. Another strategy that has gained a certain amount of popularity already is the use of a fluorescent dye marker that's usually placed on high-touch surfaces by a supervisor who then goes back several days later and usually after the patient has been discharged to see if the fluorescent dye marker has actually been wiped off during the terminal cleaning process. The other question that we should ask ourselves is the surface actually clean after the housekeeper has finished? Now, I think most hospitals have been using kind of a visual assessment where they walk into the room and say, gee, does everything look pretty clean in here? And in fact, there are several studies that have shown that visual assessments are really not a very accurate way to determine if something is really clean or not. For many years, hospitals with a special interest in this issue have used cultures of surfaces after cleaning, and then they determine an aerobic colony count. So this gives an idea of how much bacterial contamination there is of surfaces. And this can definitely be helpful, and we have used this from time to time. The problem with these are that they're somewhat time-consuming. They certainly require contribution by your microbiology lab, and the results don't become available until about 48 hours after you've sampled the room. More recently, there's been a few studies that have looked at using adenosine triphosphate, or ATP, bioluminescence assays. And one of the advantages here is that the results are available pretty much immediately. Next slide. This slide just shows a very simple example of a checklist that one could give housekeepers and have them check off the high-touch surfaces as they clean the room. Next slide. Now, what about the fluorescent dye marker system? Phil Carling and his colleagues have published a number of papers on this. I've just cited here the first one that involved a prospective study done in three hospitals. And what they did is 12 high-touch objects in patients' rooms were marked with an invisible fluorescent solution after terminal cleaning. When these marks are moistened by wiping the surface with a disinfectant spray, they can be pretty easily removed with just about 5 seconds of light pressure. Now, of course, the housekeepers can't see this invisible fluorescent marker, but the picture on the right shows what it looks like if you shine an ultraviolet light where the fluorescent marker has been put onto an object. Next slide. After about at least 2 patients had occupied the rooms and the rooms had been terminally cleaned, the target surfaces were evaluated using a portable UV light to see if those markers had been wiped off by housekeepers or not. And as you might guess, they found that in a lot of instances they weren't. So then they did an intervention that involved education of housekeepers, and they started giving them some feedback about how they were doing. Next slide. Well, before the education and feedback intervention, they evaluated about 1,400 objects in patient rooms. And then during the intervention period, there were a little over 740 objects evaluated. And what they found was that before the intervention, only 47% of the surfaces that were supposed to be cleaned had actually been wiped, kind of an incredibly low number. But then after their education and feedback intervention, the proportion of objects that have been clean increased from to 76% to as high as 92% in the three hospitals. And technique improved significantly in all three hospitals. I think I mentioned earlier, this technique has been adopted in a number of other hospitals now and appears to be useful. Next slide. Now, ATP bioluminescence methods have been used for years to monitor the adequacy of cleaning in the beverage and food processing industries. And these methods detect ATP that are present in bacteria, either live or dead, as well as ATP that's in human secretions or excretions and in food. In other words, anything that's organic has ATP in it. This test method makes use of the reaction shown on the slide here, where if you have luciferase and luciferin, if you add ATP, what happens is you generate light, the same kind of light that fireflies generate on a warm summer evening. The amount of light that's produced is proportional to the concentration of ATP present. Next slide. Well, we recently did a trial of the 3M BioTrace ATP bioluminescence assay system. And with this system, you use a special swab to sample the surface. Then you place that swab into a special ATP reaction tube. After agitating the reaction tube, you put it into a handheld luminometer, which is shown on your right. And after only a few seconds, you get a digital readout of how much light was generated, and it's expressed in terms of relative light units. Next slide. Well, we conducted a prospective trial in our hospital. During phase one, the ATP bioluminescence method was used to sample five high-touch surfaces, both before and after daily cleaning in 20 rooms. But we did not tell the housekeepers that their cleaning was being monitored. Then during phase two, ATP readings were again obtained from the same five high-touch surfaces before and after daily cleaning in a little over 100 patient rooms on randomly selected nursing units throughout the hospital. Our goal here was to determine the range of ATP readings that might be achieved with reasonably good cleaning technique. And for that reason, we actually told the housekeepers in advance that when they were getting ready to clean a room, we said, okay, we're going to test this room before and after daily cleaning, because we wanted to see what kind of values we'd get if we thought they were doing a good job. Next slide. This slide shows on the y-axis the relative light unit readings, and again, the higher the reading, that means the more ATP there was on the surface. In other words, the more organic material or the dirtier the surface. And this graph shows the median relative light unit readings for each of those five high-touch surfaces. Before cleaning is shown in the dark blue, and then after daily cleaning is in the light blue. And one of the disturbing findings that we found is you can see for bed rails that the relative light unit readings were actually higher after daily cleaning, which means they were actually a little bit dirtier And in fact, in closer questioning of the housekeepers, it seemed like some of them hadn't even touched the bedside rail or did a very poor job. For overbed tables, there wasn't really any change from before and after. The TV remotes had lower relative light unit readings after cleaning, but this wasn't statistically significant. And only for bathroom grab bars and toilet seats were the ATP readings significantly lower after daily cleaning than before cleaning. Well, based on this and some colony counts that we did, we actually used some of this information for a new educational module for our housekeepers, which was presented to them by one of our infection control preventionists. And then we moved on to phase two. Next slide. This slide shows the same type of data, again with relative light units on the y-axis, both before daily cleaning in green and after daily cleaning in the dark blue. And now you can see that for each of these five high-touch surfaces, the relative light unit readings after daily cleaning were statistically significantly lower, which means the surfaces were really much cleaner after daily cleaning. So this really showed an improvement compared to phase one. We're currently still looking at this system to see if we can use it to give housekeepers immediate feedback on their cleaning performance. Next slide. Well, I've been talking a little bit about how to monitor cleaning. This slide has more to do with how we do cleaning. And for liquid disinfectants or detergents, some hospitals will have the housekeeper spray the disinfectant onto a surface, or they may spray it onto a cleaning cloth, and then they wipe the surface. Another approach is to soak a clean cloth in a disinfectant and then wipe the surface. A number of hospitals will use a disinfectant-impregnated wipe, and then a few hospitals use what's called a bucket method, where a cloth is soaked in disinfectant and it's used to pretty much drench the surfaces to make sure they stay wet with disinfectant for about 10 minutes. And then the surfaces are wiped dry with a clean cloth. Next slide. Well, the traditional liquid disinfectants that are used most commonly, at least in the United States and Canada, are the quaternary ammonium compounds. Then some hospitals, and for certain indications, will use phenolics. In other settings, they may use alcohol or an alcohol-based mixture. And then, in some settings, chlorine-releasing products are used. One of the newer liquid disinfectants available is accelerated hydrogen peroxide. And then the other ones listed here, in my opinion, are more experimental in nature. And they include superoxidized water, silver ion zeolite technology, polymeric biocide with silver salts, an organosilane formulation, some cationic ingredients with chlorhexidine, and some people have looked at copper-based disinfectants. Next slide. Now, what about disinfection in the rooms of patients that have C. difficile or norovirus? As you probably know, the C. diff spores and norovirus are not as susceptible to routine disinfectants like quaternary ammonium as normal bacteria. So the new CDC disinfection and sterilization guideline, which given the web address for here, recommends that in nursing units with a high rate of C. difficile associated disease, that we use a 1 to 10 dilution of household bleach for routine environmental disinfection. Some hospitals will do this only in the rooms of people who have C. diff, whereas other hospitals may do it on most of the rooms if there's C. diff patients on that particular ward. So there's two different strategies there. Currently in the United States, there's no products that are registered by the Environmental Protection Agency specifically for inactivating C. difficile spores, although the EPA has been evaluating a sodium hypochlorite product for use against C. diff spores, and it looks very likely that they will approve this type of product. And then in Canada, there's a 4.5% accelerated hydrogen peroxide liquid that has activity against C. diff spores that's been registered in Canada. This doesn't show up on your slide, but it's something I wanted to mention. Common surface disinfectants, as I mentioned earlier, have poor activity against norovirus, and some experts recommend that you use a dilute household bleach solution in the rooms of people who have norovirus infection. Next slide. Accelerated hydrogen peroxide liquid formulation has been shown to be bactericidal and virucidal in 1 minute, and mycobactericidal and fungicidal in 5 minutes. And these are label claims that are permitted by the EPA in the United States. And the claims may be slightly different in Canada. The accelerated hydrogen peroxide kind of has more desirable side effect profile than quaternary ammonium-based disinfectants. So from this standpoint, it has some advantages. It is more expensive currently than some of the quaternary ammonium compounds. But this type of product has already gained a certain amount of popularity in Canada, and in one small Canadian hospital survey, about a quarter of hospitals were using accelerated hydrogen peroxide for surface cleaning. Next slide. Vapor phase disinfectants have gained attention, particularly after the big anthrax attack in the United States in 2001, and partly because formaldehyde gas, chlorine dioxide gas, and hydrogen peroxide vapor were all used to try to decontaminate equipment or buildings that were contaminated with anthrax spores. Next slide. There are two major hydrogen peroxide vapor technologies that are commercially available. One is often described as a microcondensation process that's available from Bioqual, and the other is sometimes referred to as a dry gas process that's available from Steris. And despite the differences in the method of application, both of these technologies have been validated as being effective. Currently, most of the experience in healthcare settings is with the microcondensation process. Next slide. So the hydrogen peroxide vapor microcondensation process has been used in hospitals that have either epidemic or endemic problems with MRSA, VRE, C. difficile, Acinetobacter, and other multi-drug-resistant gram-negative pathogens. And this peroxide vapor is really effective against a broad range of healthcare-associated pathogens, including C. difficile spores. Next slide. We conducted a 10-month prospective trial at Hospital of St. Raphael in collaboration with CDC and Bioquell because we were having several years ago an increased amount of C. difficile disease. We used a pre- and post-intervention study design, and this hydrogen peroxide vapor was injected into sealed patient rooms using HPV generators until about 1 micron film of hydrogen peroxide vapor was applied. And then the generator is turned off and the hydrogen peroxide vapor is catalytically converted to oxygen and water vapor by an aeration unit. So there's really no toxic or troublesome byproducts. You just end up with oxygen and water vapor. Now, during this 10-month trial, it took us about 12 hours when we vacated a ward and then decontaminated the entire ward at the same time. And when we did individual patient rooms, it took about 3 to 4 hours per room. We're still using this technology at Hospital of St. Raphael, and the current cycle times for an individual patient room vary from about 2.3 to 3 hours. Next slide. This slide just shows a picture of the HPV generator that's used, and next to it the catalytic converter. And you can see that there's electronic equipment, computers in the room, and we leave all that equipment in the room along with hard-to-clean items because this process doesn't really cause any problems with this type of equipment. Next slide. This slide shows the results of our evaluation of the microbiologic efficacy of HPV decontamination. And immediately before decontaminating rooms, we obtained 165 swab cultures, and about 2.5% were positive for C. diff, even though some of these rooms had already been cleaned. 5% were positive for MRSA, and 14% were positive for VRE. But immediately after the HPV decontamination process, none of 155 swab cultures yielded any of these three pathogens. We also used a specialized cellulose sponge that was provided by CDC for doing surface culturing. These sponges allow us to sample a much larger surface area. And of 43 sponge cultures we did, 25% or so were positive for C. diff before HPV decontamination, and none of 37 sponge cultures done afterwards were positive. So based on these findings, we concluded that the hydrogen peroxide vapor was efficacious in eradicating C. diff, MRSA, and VRE from environmental surfaces. Next slide. Now, we also looked at the impact of HPV decontamination on the incidence of new nosocomially acquired C. diff cases. And on the figure on your left, the y-axis shows the C. diff incidence. And you can see that during the trial period, the C. diff incidence was substantially lower than during the 10-month period before the trial, but the difference was not statistically significant. When we restricted this analysis to only those months both before and during the trial when the epidemic NAP1 strain of C. diff was present in our hospital, then the C. diff incidence was significantly reduced during the trial period compared to the period prior to the trial. So this HPV technology is currently being evaluated in a number of other hospitals, and they're looking at other marker organisms to do further studies of its efficacy and to look at its impact on transmission of healthcare-associated pathogens. Next slide. In Europe, at least, there's a system that's called the hydrogen peroxide dry mist system from a company called Sterinus. Again, this is not Steris, but Sterinus. And with this system, it injects particles ranging from about 8 to 12 microns into a room. The disinfectant used has a much lower concentration of hydrogen peroxide than either of the hydrogen peroxide vapor systems that I mentioned earlier. This disinfectant contains 5% hydrogen peroxide plus some silver ions and phosphoric acid. And in several studies, it's been shown to reduce bacterial contamination in both experimental and actual hospital rooms. Based on a couple of studies that have been conducted to date, it looks like this system is probably less efficacious against C. difficile spores than the hydrogen peroxide vapor system, but I think more formal controlled trials are needed to establish the relative efficacy of these two different systems. Next slide. You may have heard about an alcohol quaternary ammonium mist system wherein a disinfectant is sprayed onto surfaces, kind of as shown on the picture on your right. Because it contains alcohol, the mist evaporates pretty quickly on surfaces so that it's not necessary to wipe the surfaces afterwards. The disinfectant contains 58.6 alcohol plus a 4-chain quaternary ammonium, and these are suspended in a carbon dioxide carrier to render the mist non-flammable. At least one study that was presented at the recent SHEA meeting found that this system significantly reduced VRE and MRSA on hospital surfaces. They didn't provide any evidence regarding its activity against C. difficile spores. And the authors of this abstract concluded that it wasn't as consistently effective as the 1 to 10 solution of bleach, which they used as their control in the study. Next slide. Some other area decontamination strategies that you may have heard about include this ultraviolet light surface decontamination system, which is a mobile unit like the one shown on your right. And this is being evaluated in several medical centers now to look at how effectively it decontaminates hospital rooms. Gaseous ozone and superoxidized water fogging are a couple of other methods that have been looked at. And then there's a quaternary ammonium so-called dry mist system that a few hospitals have used. And I couldn't find any published studies in peer-reviewed journals describing this system, and I haven't seen any data on its efficacy against C. difficile spores. But I'm guessing that since quaternary ammonium disinfectants in general are not very effective against C. difficile, I'm not sure whether this particular system would work very well. I think they need to conduct studies to look at this issue. Next slide. Well, in summary, improving cleaning and disinfection practices in hospitals requires that we develop detailed protocols and do some education of housekeepers. And then we need to actually do some kind of monitoring of cleaning and hopefully provide housekeepers with some actual feedback about how they're doing. some of the methods that have been used for monitoring the adequacy of cleaning include checklists using that fluorescent dye markers that I mentioned, looking at the use of ATP bioluminescence methods, and using surface cultures. I mentioned that there are new liquid disinfectants like the accelerated hydrogen peroxide that have recently become available, and there are some other ones that are more in experimental phases that may have persistent antimicrobial activity when applied to surfaces, and I think that these products also warrant further investigation. Hydrogen peroxide vapor, the mobile UV light systems, and other newer area decontamination systems, I think, warrant further evaluation to look at their effectiveness and determine their impact on the transmission of healthcare-associated pathogens. Some issues to consider when you're evaluating liquid disinfectants or area decontamination systems include the effectiveness against bacteria, including C. difficile spores, and their activity against viruses, including non-envelope viruses like norovirus or the norovirus surrogates that are used in laboratory testing. We also need to look at the ease of application, the speed of action, or the room turnaround times involved. We need to look at materials compatibility, adverse effects on housekeepers, patients, and the environment, and the impact on pathogen transmission, as well as the cost of the different approaches. Next slide. This is the final slide, and I've listed the internet website addresses for the HCPCS environmental guideline, their MDRO guideline, and the new HCPCS disinfection and sterilization guideline, as well as a website for the Canadian hand hygiene disinfection and sterilization guideline. I'm sure there's some other websites out there, so I don't mean to purposely exclude them, but these are the ones I had room to list on this slide. So, Paul, I think I will stop at this point.
Thank you very much, Dr. Boyce. I'm glad that your voice held out through the whole hour.
Me too.
Well done. In your hydrogen peroxide vapor testing at your hospital, presuming the room had to be pre-cleaned, was there an estimate of the cost to decontaminate a room using that system?
Yeah, that's a good question, and I can't actually answer your question, but the hydrogen peroxide vapor system, because it requires the use of these special equipment, and you have to monitor the process using a laptop computer that's set immediately outside the room and is hooked to monitoring equipment inside the room, and of course there can't be any patient in the room when this occurs. And this system pretty clearly costs quite a bit more than sending a housekeeper into a room with some disinfectant wipes.
Right.
So one of the major concerns that people have about this system is it really cost effective? Because there is additional cost involved. And I think that further studies are necessary to look at this. But because it's so effective at decontaminating rooms, in some settings where you're having really important problems with C. difficile or resistant gram-negatives that you can't seem to get rid of with your regular cleaning processes, and there's significant disease occurring, then in those settings it may actually be cost-effective. And we did some very kind of simple cost-effectiveness analyses in our hospital after the 10-month trial, and it looked like, given the published estimates of the additional cost of a C. diff case and looked at how many fewer C. diff cases occurred during the trial period compared to the 10-month baseline period, it looked to us and to our hospital administration that this was at least cost neutral or maybe cost savings.
Mm.
And of course, the other issue is that if you're having really serious disease, like a lot of people undergoing colectomies for C. diff, or in some settings where they've had really persistent problems with resistant gram-negatives in a neonatal ICU where you have deaths occurring, then if you can stop transmission by using this kind of technology, then, you know, it's probably worth the additional cost. The other issue that a lot of people are concerned about with this technology is the turnaround time, the fact that it takes maybe 2.5 hours just to do the hydrogen peroxide vapor part of it. And when we first started to use it in our hospital, everybody said, oh, forget it. There's no way we're going to tie up a patient room for that long to get it decontaminated. But in fact, we have a paper that will be coming out in Infection Control and Hospital Epidemiology that describes the fact that even though we have a fairly high census, that it is logistically possible to do quite a few rooms even when the census is high.
Thank you for that. I am so pleased that Dr. Boyce has been able to join us today, even though he's had a croaky throat and a cold. I thank you very much for your time, sir. It's been time very well spent for me and for our audience. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul.
And to everyone, I would like to thank you. A special thanks to Virox for their sponsorship of today's teleclass and their support of teleclass education as a whole. John and Melissa and Nicole and everyone at Virox, thank you very, very much. So to all, we will talk to you again very soon. Goodbye.